good evening, or good morning if you're on the other side of the world. This, of course, is John St. Germain, and you're listening to the Crystal Silence League Radio Hour. And I'm not sure exactly what is going on with the audio, because Blog Talk Radio is a wild and wonderful wilderness on the internet. But hopefully you are listening to me tonight, and if you are, then by golly, it's a wonderful thing. So we have a strange thing. I'm just looking at the control panel, and all sorts of strange and wonderful things are going on there. So, hey, who knows? But tonight, our topic, of course, is the seven wings of enlightenment. We're going to talk about those various things, those various topics. And I love discussing this stuff. And if I seem a little weird tonight, I've been working on my taxes for the past 2 days. And man, if there's anything that will test your peace of mind, your equanimity, and your grounding, it is doing taxes. And I found out that I owed about three times what I actually earned last year. And if you think that's not possible, you've never been self-employed. So why don't we have a brief musical interlude, and we'll come back with our prayers for the week, and our stone of the week, and our topic of the week. So why don't you grab a frosty beverage, a warm beverage, a frosty crystal ball, or a warm crystal ball, and we'll be right back. This is John St. Germain. Welcome to the Crystal Silence League Hour. And for those of you who don't know about the Crystal Silence League, it was founded around 1917 by Claude Alexander Conlon for the purpose of distributing and projecting positive affirmations to those in need. And this is done through the aid of a crystal ball. And when he passed into the silence around 1958 or so, of course, the Crystal Silence League went with him until 2011, when spiritual adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church brought it back to life on the internet in cybernetic form. And so this worldwide web of crystal ball gazers became worldwide web on the cybernet, and we still do the crystal ball gazing, and we teach it online and also in print. We have books that you can get from us. We have crystal gazing lessons, and we have crystal ball lessons that you can buy for a low price of $5. And also, if you just buy a crystal ball from us, you get one of these books free. The four branches of crystal gazing are taught both on this show, in our archives. That's hard to say, in our archives, and the also online and in print. We're also working on a book, which is under the editorial process right now, on modern techniques for crystal ball gazing. And so, if you go online, you'll notice that people post prayers, and prayer is always free at the Crystal Silence League, and we get literally hundreds of prayers every week, and it is my custom each week to download some of those prayers and read a sample of them. We never identify names on the air. This is anonymous, and we only identify by prayer ID. So if you will, join me in prayer for the following people. And the first one is prayer ID number 47578. Who prays, this young lady prays that her boyfriend will fall in love with her in the next 7 days. And, you know, we hope that happens. We hope that's a match made in heaven. And we have prayer ID number 47577, who prays for reconciliation between her and her boyfriend, and prays that her boyfriend will open his heart and let her in. Valentine's Day is coming up. You know, relationships are going to be to the forefront. prayer ID number 47576, who prays for the removal of negativity and curses, and says that she and her daughter have been in the targets of envy, malice, gossip, and spiritual attack, even in the same within the family, even. And the effects are still with them, and she prays for the lifting of these evil energies. Prayer ID number 47575, thanks St. Anthony and thanks Jesus for helping her find her paperwork. Good. That's good. And we have an anonymous prayer, which is prayer ID number 47574, who wants us to pray for her mother, who has an appointment to get her stomach and liver checked. And she has swelling and discomfort, and she prays for her body to be healed. Prayer ID number 47573 prays that her man's transportation situation will be resolved. And we have prayer ID number 47572 prays that her family will be happy. Prayer ID number 47571 prays for a financial miracle. After doing my taxes, pray for me to have a financial miracle, please. Prayer ID number 47570 says thanks for Saints Anthony, Saint Expedite, Saint Jude, Saint Michael, the Sun, Venus, and Jupiter. And this person is trying to figure out the best way to pay them. And prays for the ancestors to forgive this person for being so confused. Prayer ID number 47569 prays that his or her application for citizenship goes through smoothly. And then we have prayer ID number 47568, who prays for her friend RT to have protection from her devious landlord who's trying to have her evicted. And this appears to be all the prayers that I have this week. Let's have a prayer for all those in need of comfort and for assistance. And let's take a moment to pray for all those in need. Jade has many qualities. Jade has always been linked with love, of successful love especially, and Chinese legend says that jade carved into a diamond, a butterfly shape, has special romantic significance. And there's an old Chinese legend that tells of a youth who strayed into a garden of a wealthy mandarin in pursuit of a very special butterfly. But instead of being punished for his trespassing, through a convoluted series of events, he wound up married to the mandarin's daughter. So this jade butterfly symbolizes successful courtship and pursuit of love. Jade is a protective stone in some cultures. It's a talisman against accidents and misfortunes. And in some spells, you'll place a piece of jade between two purple candles and let them burn. And this will charge the candle, or charge the candles charge the stone with protective energy. Jade is used in prosperity spells. Being green, it attracts prosperity and positive energies toward job finding and bringing money in. And, of course, it's used to attract love. In chakra work, of course, jade resonates with the heart chakra. I should talk more about chakras on the show, since crystal work and chakra work go hand in hand. There's a lot about chakras that is misunderstood in Western culture. The I often get online and talk. I was on Facebook, in fact, talking to some people who were very adamant about what they read about chakras. And in Western culture, because of translation errors and translation, well, just conceptual errors. If you look at a chart of chakras, you see the seven chakras in different locations, you know, from the crown to the stem. And this has led to a misapprehension that the seven chakras are located there, like your hands are located in your arms and your eyes are located in your head. And if you go back to the ancient literature, you find this is not the case. There are many systems of chakra studies. Some there are 30 chakras in some, 9 in some, 10 in some, 300 in some. And people say, well, which ones are correct? Well, they're all correct because the chakras are not located on your body or along your energy line like your eyes are located in your head. If you look in the early systems of chakra teaching, those chakras are not located there. They're placed there through meditation. Those are suggested locations. And I will tell you that if you talk to some people who are adamant with the modern kind of new age interpretation of chakras, they'll tell you, no, you're born with those chakras in those locations, the crown chakras at the top of your head, the heart chakras in the middle of your chest, the root chakras at the base of your spine. And that's simply not the case. That is not the case. These were certain schools of study in yogic tradition that go way back, and that's where you were. It was suggested that you visualize them there and cultivate them there. You're not born with them there. And I know I'm flying in the face of a lot of New Age and Western yogic tradition, but you know, do the reading. Look in some of the older books, like the Epitome of the Great Seal, that these things come from. And this is why you were taught to visualize four petals and six petals. The chakras themselves don't have these petals. You visualize that as part of the meditation process. And this is all leading to something of our topic this week. And you were taught to visualize certain elements, you know, the earth element in the root chakra, the wind element, air element in the heart chakra. But you could change these. Again, this is blasphemous to some of the modern teachers of this, but I want to ask you a question. If you always use wind and air in the heart element, in the heart chakra, how do you ever ground the heart? And this may explain to you why so many yoga teachers and chakra teachers have disastrous relationships and disastrous abilities to express emotions or deal with emotions, because they're always placing wind element in the heart. And when I suggest perhaps you should try to put earth element in the heart, do earth grounding in the heart, use a red stone there, use a black stone or brown stone there, they think, oh my God, you know, you're a madman. But look at the old ways. That's what they used to do. They shift the elements around. They would put air where it was needed. You could put air in the heart. You could put earth in the heart. You can put any element, fire in the heart, whichever one is necessary. You can do this. You can switch it up. You better know what you're doing, though, because you can really mess yourself up. Our topic tonight, that's my sermon on the chakras tonight. But you know, you don't want to be in the business for an hour and a half, and then try to do this. You need to know. You need to be conversant with the chakra techniques before you do things like this. But read the old books. Don't read the new books that were written in 1982. Read the ones that were written in 1982 BC and get the dope, get the straight dope. We're talking about the seven wings of enlightenment. We're up to number five, which is tranquility. This is the fifth factor of enlightenment, and in Pali it's called pasadi. P-A-S-S-A-D-D-H-I, pasadi. Doesn't that sound calm? Pasadi. You can just see somebody freaking out, running in circles. Going, oh my God, I'm freaking out. You go, pasadi, pasadi, calm, tranquility. Now, pasadi is a twofold quality. Pasadi is calm of body, and pasadi is calm of mind. When you experience an emotion, you'll notice that there are two sides to it. There's a physical side and a mental side. When you feel fear and anger and love, etc., there's a physical reaction and a mental reaction. This is very important. Buddhism stresses this a lot. Anytime there's pain, anytime there's anger, anytime there's anything, there's a physical component and a mental component. Sometimes you can't do much about the mental or about the physical component, but you can always do something about the mental component. Part of dealing with pain, you're taught in Buddhism this, part of dealing with pain is to calm the mind. There's not, you know, there's a saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. And that's what it's meant. You can't stop the physical pain, but you can calm the mind. And that fear and terror and aversion and panic that arises when we're experiencing physical pain adds another dimension of suffering that can be eliminated. So pasadi is twofold. There's kaya pasadi, which is calm of body, and citta pasadi, which is the calm of the mind. That's the aggregate of consciousness. And it's calmed. So all the mental properties, rather than the physical body, is the aggregate of feelings, perception, and the volitional activities of the mind. So we're dealing with many, many things here. The body is simple. Calming the body is simple. Calming the mind, you have to go very deep. You have to think about the aggregates of feeling, perception, and the volitional activities, which we've discussed in the past. So pasadi is compared to the happy experience of a weary traveler who's walked many, many, many miles in the hot sun, who sits down under a tree in the shade, or the cooling of a hot place by cool rain. It's hard to tranquilize the mind, though. It's very hard. The mind is shaken by experience. And it trembles, and it's difficult to guard, it's difficult to hold back. I read where one place, it reminds me, every time I think of that, it quivers like a fish taken from the watery home and thrown upon a dry and barren ground. And it wanders at will, it's a monkey mind. This is the nature of this subtle mind, and then there's an ultra-subtle mind. The more you train your mind, the more you find nooks and crannies that need calming. There's a systematic reflection that helps the one who aspires to enlightenment to quiet this fickle and troublesome mind. But unless a man cultivates this tranquility of mind, concentration can't be successfully developed. You really can't develop concentration with a troubled mind. A tranquilized mind, or a tranquil mind, will keep away and hold at bay most futile and superficial distractions. Now, one of our problems is that today we think that freedom and unrestraint are the same thing, and that taming yourself is a hindrance to self-development. That is, if you practice restraint, you're limiting yourself. But in the teachings of the Buddha, it's different. The self must be subdued and tamed if it's to become truly well, but along correct lines. Restraint, just for the sake of restraint, can be cloying and frustrating. One of the titles of the Buddha is the Tathagata, which is means the thus come one, but it also means the tamed one, the disciplined one. So the Tathagata teaches the Dharma for the purpose of taming the human heart. And there's a phrase in Pali, Danto so bhagava dhammataya dhammam dasetti. The teacher comes to tame the human heart. Or so thus the teacher comes to tame the human heart. So it's only when the mind is tranquil and kept to the right road of orderly progress that the mind is useful at all to he who possesses it. And for society in general, the untamed mind is the source of all the problems in the world right now. A disorderly mind is a liability, both to the owner and to everyone around him. All the havoc and suffering brought in the world today is wrought by people who have not learned the way of mental calm, balance, and poise. I state that without fear of contradiction. You know, argue about it on the internet if you like, but all the havoc in the world today is brought about by people, by men and women, who have not learned the way of mental calm, balance, and poise. calmness is not a weakness. It's not a weakness to be calm and unperturbed. The calm attitude at all times shows a cultivated and cultured human being. But to be composed in mind in the midst of unfortunate circumstances is very hard. Right now I'm extremely upset by how much tax I owe. It's about 25% of what I made this year. Actually, it's more than that. It's about 30%. It's about 30% of what I made this year, even after all my deductions. I saw this amount of money, and I just don't have it. I'm thinking, I've paid taxes all year, and I just don't have this. How am I going to get it? But I know I will. I know that I will. But at the moment, I'm thinking, my God, but I'm composed in mind. I'm composed in body, because what's going to happen? You know, I'll figure out a way to pay it. But the most deceptive thing in the world is to imagine that those who are noisy, those who possess power, those who make a lot of noise, those who have a lot of money, those who have a lot of possessions, those who brag a lot, that's deceptive. The most deceptive thing in the world is to imagine that they are strong. They are not strong. Those who brag and make noise and make a lot of sound and blow things up are not strong. The difficult quality of a calm and imperturbable mind shows strength of character and control. So the person who cultivates this calm of the mind doesn't get upset or confused or excited when confronted with the eight vicissitudes of the world. And there are eight of them. And we'll go into that at some point, because that's a discussion for another day. But this person endeavors to see the rise and fall of all things conditioned, how all things come into being and pass away. And so, freed from this anxiety and restlessness, he or she will see the fragility of the fragile. And I'll tell you that there's a story in Buddhism, and some of these stories we don't quite understand, and you have to see them from the perspective of someone who has achieved true tranquility. There's a story in the Majjhima Nikaya, tells how a mother was asked why she did not lament and feel pain over the death of her beloved son. And she said, "Uninvited he came, uninvited he passed away. As he came, so he went. What use is there in lamenting, weeping, and wailing?" And this is the advantage of a tranquilized mind. We might see this as unfeeling or uncaring, but it really isn't. It really isn't. It's an admission that we come into this world and we pass away. A tranquilized mind is unshaken by loss or gain, blame and praise, and undisturbed by the adversity of life. And this frame of mind is brought about by viewing the sentient world in its proper perspective. Pasadi leads a man or a woman to enlightenment and deliverance from suffering. The truly enlightened mind sees that sentient beings come into this world and leave this world, and no amount of lamenting, weeping, and wailing is going to change that. That's part of the deal. It's part of the deal. And, you know, this hurts us because of our sentimentality. We get a dog or a cat, we fall in love with the dog and the cat, and we know the moment we get that dog or cat that one day that dog or cat or snake or hamster, we know the moment we get it one day that animal is going to break our heart, unless we outlive that animal, and that's unlikely. But we know that. And no amount of weeping and wailing and lamentation is going to change the fact that a cat or a dog lives about 12 years, and we live about 100. And it is a mystery to me. And I'm a cat lover. I have two cats right now, and in my lifetime I've had maybe 24 cats. And every time they pass away, I think, oh, this is an awful world. This is what I think in my mind. I said, this is an awful world. I hate this world, because of that very thing, that we are so constructed that we form attachments to things, people and things and animals and each other, when we know when we know that by doing so, we're going to break our own hearts. And that is the tragedy of being human. And the truly enlightened mind, the truly calm mind, understands that we come into this world, we pass out of this world, and there's really no need for lamentation, weeping, and wailing. All we're doing is trying to deny the impermanence of this life that we're in. So the sixth enlightenment factor, number six, is samadhi, concentration. And only the tranquilized mind can easily concentrate upon a subject of meditation. This is, we're talking about meditation now. And the calm and concentrated mind sees things as they really are. And the unified mind brings the five hindrances under subjugation. And we'll talk about that. We have talked about the five hindrances. We'll talk about them again at some point. Concentration is the intensified steadiness of the mind, comparable to the unflickering flame of a lamp in a windless place. It's concentration that fixes the mind aright and causes it to be unmoved and undisturbed. And correct practice of samadhi maintains the mind and the mental properties in a state of balance, like a steady hand holding a pair of scales. Right concentration dispels passions, the passions that disturb the mind, and brings purity and makes the mind placid, calm. Here's another metaphor for you, like the surface of a lake unbroken by the wind. The concentrated mind is not distracted by sense objects, and concentration of the highest type can't be disturbed under the most adverse circumstances. There was a story that was told by a bhikkhu I knew, a monk that I knew, who said that he had a friend who entered a very high stage of samadhi to the point where his sister, with whom he lived, thought he had died. His respiration seemed to stop. She couldn't find a pulse, and she couldn't awaken him. And she called some EMTs. This was in Thailand, where in a part of Thailand, he was a forest monk, where apparently technology wasn't that advanced. And through a stethoscope, they could not hear his heartbeat. His heart and respiration had slowed to an immense state. So they loaded him up in a very old Cadillac ambulance, apparently, and they're taking him to the hospital to have him declared dead. And in the ambulance, he woke up and looked around and said, "What's going on?" And he scared the EMTs half to death because they thought he was dead, as if a corpse came to life. And none of that disturbed him. He was so deep in samadhi that he was unaware of anything that went on, including his sister's being upset, the paramedics poking him, pounding on his chest, trying to revive him, and everything else. So apparently he was in a very deep, he'd gone deeper than he ever had before. So one who's intent upon reaching these depths of samadhi should develop a love of virtue, which is called sila, for it's virtue that nourishes mental life and makes it coherent and calm. The mind becomes filled with rich content, and the unrestrained mind dissipates itself in frivolous activity. It jumps around like a monkey, and can never retain this cohesiveness and this calmness. And this is one of the hardest ones of the seven factors, this calm mind. And calm doesn't mean upset or agitated all the time. It often just means inattentive. So many, many are the impediments and distractions that confront a yogi who aspires for enlightenment, but there are five particular hindrances that hinder concentrative thought and samadhi and obstruct the way to deliverance from this mess we find ourselves in. In Buddhist teachings, they're known as pancha nivarana, the five hindrances. The Pali term nivarana basically means hindrances, hindrances that obstruct clear mind states. And mental development is called bhavana, B-H-A-V-A-N-A, bhavana. They're called hindrances because they completely close in and cut off and obstruct. That's why they're called hindrances. they close the doors to liberation. And here are the five hindrances. I've looked them up for you so I don't get them wrong. One is sensual desires. Two is ill will. Three is stubbornness of mind and mental factors. The mind is very stubborn. It resists change. Four is restlessness and worry. And five is doubt. And I tell people that's the toughest one. I tell people all the time, doubt will kill you in this business. If you're trying to do mental projections, if you're trying to use attraction, and if you're trying to bring things into your life, if you're trying to make change, doubt will kill you in this business. And, you know, by killing you, I'm almost literal. Doubt will ruin your life in this business. So sensual desires or intense cravings for either possessions or the satisfaction of base desires is the first thing that binds us to samsara, the first thing that binds us to this world, repeated wandering from life to life, and it closes the door to final liberation. And so, you know, what is this sensuality, and where does this craving arrive from, this craving that we call tanha? Tanha means thirst. Where does this thirst arise, and where does it take root? And at the very beginning of all this, we started the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. You might remember that, the Satipatthana Sutta. And the Buddha said, where there is the delightful and the pleasurable, there this craving arises and takes root. Forms, sounds, smell, taste, body contact, and ideas, the five skandhas of craving, delightful and pleasurable. And so this thirst arises and takes root. And craving, when it's obstructed by some cause, is transformed to frustration and wrath. When our cravings are frustrated, when they're hindered, when they're blocked, we become frustrated and we become angry. And the Dhammapada, which is a wonderful little book of sayings of the Buddha, that's something you can carry in your pocket. It's a wonderful thing. I used to carry one when I was in school. I carried one in my pocket, and every time something came up that bugged me, I'd pull it out. My favorite saying from the Dhammapada is, just as a rock remains unmoved by the wind and the rain, so does the wise one remain unmoved by praise or blame. I love that saying. But the Dhammapada says, from craving arises grief, from craving arises fear. To one who is free from craving, there is no grief, there is no fear. So the next hindrance is ill will, hatred, aversion. So the mind of a human being naturally revolts against the unpleasant and the disagreeable. You know, that's the pleasure principle. Freud recognized that we move toward pleasure and away from pain. And to be separate, you know, Buddha said it before Freud, to be separated from the loved is painful, and equally painful is the union with the loathed, the union with the unpleasant, equally painful. Even a disagreeable food, you know, if you hate your spinach, an unpleasant drink, that, you know, that medicine they used to give you as a kid, an unlovely face, you know, someone who looks unattractive, 100 other small things that you run across in a day's time may cause indignation and anger, unpleasantness. If you went through the day and just made a check mark on a piece of paper about everything that caused you displeasure, even the slightest bit of displeasure, just the slightest bit, you go, oh, I don't like that, I don't like that, I don't like that, you would probably put down 100 or hundreds, depending on how picky you are, things. The things you read on the internet, things you saw on the news, especially today, this presidential thing, it's an abomination. Every time you turn around, you'd find something. You'd make that sheet black with marks. But this is wrong thinking. It's unsystematic and uncritical reflection that brings about hatred. Because when hatred and aversion arises in the mind, we're resisting the way things are. We're in denial about the way things are. We're resisting reality. And then we're causing disturbance in the mind. We're going away from tranquility. The hindrance is ill will, hatred, aversion. It distorts the mind. It clouds the vision. Now, hatred breeds hatred. there's a saying, you can't put out a fire by pouring gasoline on it. And we'll never learn that. We try to end war by dropping a bomb. That, okay, you know, I don't know why we can't. You know, that even as a little kid, I knew that wasn't going to work. We're going to end fighting by fighting. Okay, even as a kid, I said that doesn't make any sense. Hatred clouds the vision, and it distorts the entire mind. When you get hate in your mind, it distorts everything. It distorts everything, and it hinders recognizing the truth about anything. It hinders the truth. It blocks the way to the path leading to freedom. So lust and hatred based on ignorance, and ignorance is the crowning corruption of all of our insanity, are the root causes of strife and dissension and disagreement and everything between human and human and nation and nation. And as far as I know, animal and animal, microbe against microbe. Ignorance and hatred. Lust and hatred based on ignorance is the cause of everything, everything. You know, you say, is it that simple? It is that simple and that complicated. So the third hindrance consists of a pair of wickedry, lassitude, or morbid state of the mind. I can tell you what it's in Pali. It's called Thina and Mita. Thina is lassitude, laziness, or morbid state of the mind, and Mita is a morbid state of the mental properties. It's not sluggishness of the body. It's not laziness of the body. Because even the liberated ones, the arhats, the perfect ones, who are free from Thina and Mita, experience body fatigue. But Thina and Mita retard mental development. Under the influence of Thina and Mita, the mind is inert, like butter too stiff to spread, or like molasses sticking to a spoon. So what we're looking at is a stubbornness of mind. There's a laziness of mind that makes it difficult to learn new things, or flexibility, a laxity. It's a dangerous enemy of mental development. It leads to greater laxity or greater stubbornness until finally there arises a state of callous indifference. And this flabbiness of character is a fatal block to righteousness and freedom. It's through mental effort that one overcomes this pair of evils. And mental effort is one of the steps of the Eightfold Path, which we'll be discussing before too terribly long. So it takes a great deal of mental effort to break through this indifference or this inertia that we're talking about here. So the fourth hindrance comprises, again, twin drawbacks, restlessness and brooding, or flurry and worry, as one of my friends used to call it, flurry and worry. So as a rule, anyone who commits evil is mentally excited and restless. This is a generalization, but fairly true. The guilty and the impatient suffer from this hindrance. The minds of human beings who are restless and unstable are like flustered bees in a shaken hive. This mental agitation impedes meditation and blocks the upward path. Equally terrible is mental worry. Often people repent over the evil actions they've committed. And this is not praised by the Buddha, believe it or not. Remorse and regret is not praised by the Buddha. Buddha would be the first person to tell you it's useless to cry over spilt milk. And instead of brooding over these shortcomings and misdeeds, one should endeavor not to repeat them again. One should resolve never repeat unwholesome deeds. There are others who worry over the good deeds omitted and duties left undone, the sin of omission. This too serves no purpose. It's just as futile to ask the further bank of a river to come over and join this bank of the river that we may get to the other side. I mean, do you see the point? You know, it's like trying to cross a river by asking the other side of the river to come to us, that it is to regret the past. Instead of uselessly fretting about what good one has failed to do, one should endeavor to perform wholesome deeds. This mental unsteadiness is a big hindrance to mental progress. You see, fretting about what you haven't done, that you should have done, I should have, I would have, I could have, I shouldn't have, I shouldn't have, I shouldn't have. It's an impediment. And the fifth and last hindrance is doubt. Is doubt. And I'm like a broken record about this. Doubt will kill you. Doubt will kill you in mental development. Doubt will kill you in spiritual development. Doubt will kill you in this business. The Pali term for doubt is pretty. It's vikachika. Vikachika. I can just imagine these old monks hitting you in the back with a stick going, vikachika. And it literally means medicineless. The Pali term vikachika means medicineless. So one who suffers from perplexity and doubt is suffering from a disease. This is how they saw it. This is how those old guys saw it. And until you shed these doubts, you'll continue to suffer from this disease. Isn't that something? Isn't that cool? So as long as man is subject to this mental itching, he'll continue to take a cynical view and of things, which is very detrimental to mental and spiritual development. So the commentators, like Buddhaghosa, explain this hindrance, the inability to decide anything definite. It's called eel wriggling in the commentaries, eel wriggling. It also comprises doubt with regard to the possibility of attaining the jhanas, the advanced states of concentration, the possibility of enlightenment, the possibility of the siddhis, which are the supernormal accomplishments that can be attained. So in this connection, you could add that even non-Buddhists and yogis who are not concentrated with the Buddha Dharma and the Sangha at all can inhibit doubt and gain the jhanas. Even non-Buddhists can gain the jhanas if they remove doubt. So a yogi who attains the jhanas inhibits all five hindrances by the five factors of jhanas. So you inhibit this by one-pointedness or unification of the mind, by joy, which we discussed, by applied thought, which we've discussed, by happiness, which we've discussed, by sustained thought, which we've discussed. The attainment of jhanas, however, that's not the end you aim at. Jhanas arise spontaneously from meditative absorption. So the jhanas should be made to lead to vipassana, which is intuitional insight. It's a form of meditation. And it's through these insights that the yogi eradicates the latent corruptions and attains perfect purity. So you see, this is not just something that we talk about. The hindrances are not an abstract thought and say, oh, it'd be nice to get rid of these hindrances. It's a step to the goal. It's a necessary thing. So as long as these impurities or taints exist in a man's mind, even in a latent form, so long will these arising of evil continue. And not a small thing. Remember, not a small thing. It is this agitation of the mind that leads to the hate, aversion, lust, and clinging that perpetuates the evil in the world today. So the practitioner of jhana, whose purpose is to attain vipassana, or the intuitional insight, will not commit any evil action because the hindrances are inhibited, but because he has the impurities latent in his makeup, and therefore he's not yet in a state of absolute security. But the arahant, who is the perfectly enlightened person, wipes out all the latent impurities at the root and brings this repetitive, wandering, samsaric suffering to an end. And in him, samsara is indubitably ended. There's no doubt, no doubt. For by him, the noble life has been perfected and the task is done. There's no more rebirth. And that, see, that's the goal. So if you're bent on deep study, you cut yourself off from these sense attractions and you retire to a congenial atmosphere and you hold fast to these studies. Therefore, you steer yourself through all these disturbing factors and you attain success. And in the same way, seated in a quiet place, far from the crowd's ignoble strife, it says in the scriptures, the yogi, the meditator, fixes his mind on the subject of meditation, and by struggle and relentless effort, inhibits the five hindrances. And he washes out the impurities of the mind flux and gradually reaches the first, the second, the third, and the fourth jhana. Then, by the power of this samadhi, this concentrative thought, he turns his mind to the understanding of the highest sense of reality. And at that stage, the yogi cultivates vipassana, the highest type of intuitional insight. And it's through this vipassana that he understands the real nature of all component and conditioned things. This vipassana will aid you or anyone else that achieves it to see things as they truly are. And when you see face to face truth, and you comprehend that all tones are just variations struck on the one chord that runs through all life, this chord being anicca, dukkha, and anatta, impermanence, sorrow, and not self. And we shall now stop for station identification.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Arman broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times, comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
And we're back. We rule the internet. LMC, we rule the internet. We are now up to the seventh and last factor of enlightenment. And in my opinion, this is the one well worth cultivating, equanimity. In the Abhidharma, which is a book that is one of the Tipitaka, the Tripitaka in Sanskrit, which is the triple basket. The Abhidharma is attributed to Sariputra, which is Buddha's number one disciple. Abhidharma is advanced Dharma. It's Buddhist psychology. And you can get the Comprehensive Manual of Abhidharma, which is a condensation of the 6.5 feet that the Abhidharma basket will take on your shelf. Equanimity is called upekkha, and it is indicated by a very long term, which is translated as neutrality. And as it is explained in the distinction, is extremely important that it's mental equipoise, not hedonic indifference. It's not like, well, whatever, dude. It's not this psychological ailment of not caring. It's neutrality. Equanimity is the result of a calm and concentrated mind. And it's very difficult to be undisturbed when touched by this world. But the person who cultivates equanimity is never upset, never disturbed. Now, amidst this awful world of experience, gain and loss, reputation, and loss of reputation, you know, you can say good repute and ill repute, praise and blame, pain and happiness, the person possessed of equanimity never wavers. This person is firm as a rock. And, of course, this describes the Arhat, the perfectly enlightened person. Of him, it is truly said, truly the good give up longing for everything. The good prattle not with thoughts of craving, touched by happiness or by pain. The wise show neither elation nor depression. If they could put that in a pill, they'd make a fortune. So refraining from intoxicants and becoming heedful, and having a firm establishment in patience and purity, these very wise people train their minds. And it's through this training that a quiet mind is achieved. Now, can you and I achieve this? Well, yes. But how do we do it? Well, you don't do it by doing some great and powerful thing. It's not through an act of sacrifice or through a spiritual climbing a mountain or anything. Why were the saints saints? And well, because they were cheerful when it was difficult to be cheerful, and patient when it was difficult to be patient, and strong when it was difficult to be strong. They pushed on when it was easy to give up, and they kept quiet when they wanted to shout. And that was it. They went against their inclinations. And it's simple, but very, very hard. It's a matter of mental hygiene. So mention is made in all throughout the books, the Pali Canon and the millions of books that have been written by Buddhism, of four wrong paths to go down, four wrong paths. The path of greed, of hate, of cowardice, and of delusion. And if you want the Pali for that, Greed is chanda, hate is dosa, cowardice is baya, and delusion is moha. And moha is mentioned more than anything. Moha. Not mohawk, moha. So people commit evil because of one of these four paths. You can attribute them to any one of these four. Because people are enticed or lured, and this is true, this is the way it's described, people are enticed or lured down one or more of these wrong paths. But the person who's reached perfect neutrality through the cultivation of equanimity avoids these paths. He cannot be lured down these paths. You can't cheat an honest man, they say. So his serenity and his neutrality enables him or her to see all things impartially. So a certain understanding of the working of karma and how karma comes into fruit is necessary if you're genuinely bent on cultivating equanimity. In the light of karma, one will be able to have a detached attitude toward all things, animate or inanimate, because the proximate cause of equanimity is the understanding that all beings, now listen to what I'm about to say, all beings are the result of their actions, which is karma. So Santideva wrote, "Some there be that loathe me, then why shall I, being praised, rejoice? Some there be that praise me, then why should I brood over blaming voice? Who master is of self will ever bear a smiling face. He puts away all frowns, is first to greet another and to share his all. This friend of all the world, truth crowns." So what we've tried to do in this very long discussion is to give a glimpse, and this is just a bare glimpse, of the seven wings of enlightenment, which was taught over 2,500 years ago by the Sammasambuddha, the Supreme Buddha, for the purpose of teaching people to attain full realization and the perfect wisdom of nirvana. And the cultivation or the neglect of these factors of enlightenment is really up to us. And with the aid of the teaching of the Buddha, we have the power to detect and destroy the causes and conditions of our own suffering. No savior. We don't rely on any savior. We don't rely on anyone else to heal us of this. Every one of us individually can put forth the necessary effort to work out our own deliverance from our own suffering. So the Buddha taught us to know life as it is and has furnished directions for such research, investigation into the causes and conditions of why we suffer and why the world suffers. And we owe it to ourselves to find out the truth of this, the truth of life and the truth of suffering for ourselves. And the Buddha never said, "This is true because I tell you it's true." He says, "Look for yourself and see if it's true." And that's why the teachings of the Buddha from beginning to end is open to anybody who has eyes to see and a mind to think. So clear is his teachings that it can never be misunderstood, except when someone misquotes a meme on Facebook. So the only thing that's really necessary on our part for the full realization of these truths is to have a firm determination to study and apply the teaching and work it out for ourselves to the best of our abilities. So these teachings, these Dharma teachings, beckon, I think, the people, those of us who are weary of the world. We look at the world and we see the world suffers and we want to know why. And we look in our own soul and we see we suffer and we want to know why. So these seven enlightenment factors are a very good place to start. And next week, we're going to take a look at the way we cultivate these factors, the path we walk to get from where we are now to where we want to be. And that would be the Noble Eightfold Path. There's a book called the Theragatha, which are songs of the enlightened ones, where the monks and nuns that studied under the Buddha wrote songs of their enlightenment. And here's a verse from it. Remembering the saints of other days and recollecting how it was they lived, even though today be but the aftertime, one yet may win the ambrosial path of peace. Mm-hmm.